This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome back an old friend to Dreamland. He is a special friend in many ways, not the least of which is he is a lifetime subscriber to unknowncountry.com. Very dear to my heart, believe me. John Ramirez was for many years a CIA officer, and his work touched on the area of UAP from time to time, and he has many interviews on the subject, including one on this show. He was introduced to me by my other CIA friend and one of my other friends in the CIA, Jim Semivan. And because I have friends in the CIA, by the way, does not mean I am an intelligent asset. It doesn't mean they are intelligence assets. Intelligent, yes, but not assets. It means only that they worked for the government and they brushed up against or worked directly on the UAP issue from time to time. John, welcome to Dreamland.
Well, Whitley, thank you very much for having me back. Looking over my notes, I see that we first interviewed back in October of 2021. And certainly since 2021 to now, much progress has been made in this topic, but much more needs to be made in this topic. And I'm, like everyone else in your audience, I'm hoping and anticipating more developments to come forward in the months and perhaps years to come from witnesses that we don't even know about yet. So I look forward to that. It's we're actually not only in the age of disclosure, but also in the age of discovery of all of these other things that have happened in this topic. So thank you again for having me.
Well, you know, the age of discovery is, of course, what interests me. I have a very different vision of disclosure than the usual vision in the close-in UFO community, which is that the government, people in the government come forth and say, we have the bodies of NHI, we have materials and so forth. Of course, that's true. And it is an inflection point of sorts, but there's something much deeper going on here. And the problem with that inflection point is it makes it sound like aliens from another planet arrived. And I think you have a slightly more nuanced view of this. Could you just kind of riff on what your large scale view of NHI is at this point?
Well, you know, if you look at the phrase or the term non-human intelligence, I would make the argument that there are already non-human intelligences on the planet who are in the animal kingdom. They're intelligent beings who are not human. And so in that sense, you know, if you have a pet, you have a dog or a cat, and you interact with your pet, there's certainly some intelligence there looking back at you. So we already have a means of communicating with NHI, but these are NHI of higher intelligence, I would say, that may have arrived on planet Earth much longer than just 1947 or in recent years in recorded history, but may have been on the planet for I don't know how long. There's speculation of tens and thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years from other folks who've looked into this. I haven't really looked into it that much, but it makes sense to me that we've been dealing with non-human intelligence throughout human history. And certainly, if you look at the religious texts of various belief systems, there are always allegories and anecdotes of humans encountering divine beings. And the humans recognize these divine beings as being of a higher order being, of a more intelligent being. And so there's has been some interactions between humans and NHI. And I think what we're seeing are the NHI who knows, may have already settled on the planet and or nearby planets or very close nearby and have visited and interacted with humans and perhaps in some ways have perhaps you could say influenced the course of human events, and perhaps through religious systems, because a lot of the old civilizations looked upon these beings as gods, and they were able to do, in their eyes, miraculous things, which perhaps can be explained by today's physics. They didn't have today's physics back then, but things happened that they could not explain. And there are UAP descriptions in the Bible, even. If you look at the Exodus of the people out of Egypt, you'll remember that there's a story of a cloud, a glowing cloud above them that provided them with manna, with food from heaven. And the glowing cloud was always there, and certain people, like the priest class, was able to interact with the beings on associated with that cloud, and to build a communication system, which they call the Ark of the Covenant, which seems to be an electromagnetic device, a transmitter receiving device, running on something like electricity or something that if you touch it without wearing certain garments that the priests wore, you can be shocked to death. And there's stories about that in the Bible. So if you step back and look at all of the ancient texts, you'll notice that, oh my goodness, humans have encountered NHI, and NHI have interacted and influenced humans throughout human history. So that's my take on it. It may not be extraterrestrials from 39 light years away, like Zeta Reticuli. It's a binary star system with no exoplanets. And now that we can see exoplanets, and it's only 39 light years away, which is relatively close to Earth, considering the astronomical scale of distances, there are no exoplanets there. But yet we have narratives of people saying, well, the grays come from Zeta Reticuli. Well, do they? Or are they something else? And so I have to take all of that into consideration. But at face value, it seems that people are encountering beings of extraordinary capabilities. People have witnessed beings walking through walls, for example, and walking through walls, and also changing shape and doing other kinds of capabilities that are beyond human understanding. So there's that to consider as well. That's the way I look at it. And so I don't disagree with people who say they're from Zeta Reticuli. I just think it's highly unlikely, and more likely that they're from closer to us, and they seem to be here all the time. And it seems like in recent years they, being the NHI, have decided to make their appearance known more readily to humans, and to the fact that we are able to collect, process, and analyze their presence using our instruments that we have in the intelligence community. So there's that to consider as well.
The past is a, it really calls to us, I think. Are you familiar with the mummies that down in Peru?
I haven't looked much into it, Whitley. I
You haven't?
know,
Okay.
no, I have
I
not.
won't go there then, except.
Right. I know the fact of that there are mummies that were
Yeah.
discovered in Peru. I know the fact of, but I haven't really looked into it.
Well, I've been involved in it for years, and giving what money I could to help the process of discovery there. And it's clear that at this point that they are, some of them are not fully human, but they have human DNA, and they are not fakes. Or there are some fakes, but they're quite fascinating in and of themselves, in that they are about 1,000 years old. And as I understand it, while they are fakes, we couldn't construct them because they're so intricately constructed. So that's just one of the anomalies. In any case, the point is this: I think they are evidence that something other than human has been here probably for a long time. But they have elements of their bodies that suggest that they might be from this world in some way. In other words, that the crypto-terrestrial hypothesis that there are other species here that we have never encountered comes up. We had a show a couple of weeks ago on Dreamland about Mac Taney's book, The Crypto-Terrestrials. And in your journey of this, in and out of the maze of the intelligence community, did you ever come across any hint that this may be deeply a terrestrial phenomenon?
No, not officially, not professionally. Just speculation based on my own personal experiences. Both you and I have had these personal experiences with other beings. Certainly, that can be considered because I just don't see an expedition from tens or hundreds or thousands of light years away to come here for a short time, get back on the craft, and return. It seems like there might be some presence here, as you say. So I certainly
Yes.
would accommodate that speculation. It seems to make the most sense that they're already here and this is for them either their home or an outpost for them. And that there are many, many species other than the proverbial and ubiquitous gray. There are other types of beings here, and some of them are very human looking. If not indistinguishable from humans. So it could have been
Yes.
other species of humans or other developed advanced species that developed alongside of us that for some reason remained hidden. In many ways, if you look at Sasquatch, it seems like that's another being that people have witnessed. Eyewitness accounts, people have been in their presence and have reported strange anomalous events associated with their presence, and they might have been, like you say, another species on the planet that are indigenous to the planet in some way that are with us but do not want to make their presence known to us.
What do you say to people who say, well, he's a CIA agent? Or they say of me, he's an intelligence asset. I've had that said of me from time to time. I'm intelligent, but I'm nobody's asset, not even my own, sadly enough. In any case, that there's something wrong, fundamentally wrong here. The CIA is a huge, the intelligence community is a huge complex organization with a lot of different facets and surfaces. Does its involvement in this, has it been an impediment or something positive in your view, based on what you know about what has been done within the community about this?
Well, certainly that's something that needs to be addressed, and I would say that there's many facets to that, and one of them is that there is a concerted effort to release some materials but keep other materials hidden. And my opinion is that the materials that are hidden, the information that is hidden, relate to the exploitation of perhaps some of the technologies recovered, or even as you say with these Peruvian mummies. The presence of other types of beings that are unacknowledged that for some reason the governments of the world want to keep hidden for whatever reason. And I don't know what those reasons are. I can speculate that they don't know the impact of this type of disclosure upon economic systems or even like belief systems that it would upset society in some way, shape, or form. But as far as CIA goes, it's within the purview of CIA to investigate, collect, process, analyze, and report on everything, everything on the planet. There's nothing off limits CIA will not touch. And so that's why it's such an expansive organization within CIA looking at very many things. And to be frank, most people don't even look at this topic. It's just a very few people that look at the topic amongst the CIA workforce. So they're not all apprised of what's going on, other than what people have seen in the media. And so there are those who have absolutely no clue, even with clearances, of what's going on, because they just don't touch it. And unless it's your job, you don't want to lay upon yourself more duties other than what you need to do as your day job. For me, it's been that way. I did not join the agency to study UFOs back in 1984. It just so happens that the topics I was looking at, the mundane, prosaic, earthbound topics I were looking at, happened to encounter some sort of phenomenon. And so, since the device I was looking at, a specific radar I was looking at, had detected these UFOs, or these what they called back then the orbs of light phenomenon, because this system detected orbs of light, then I am looking at the orbs of light. But it wasn't that I was investigating UFOs. It's an ancillary thing to what this radar detected. And so that's been throughout my career, these detections and by the collection systems that we have, both on the ground, in the air, in the sea, under the sea, and up in space, they detect these things. And so what are they? And so CIA would like to answer that question for the policymakers. What are they? And that's been my involvement in a very limited fashion of contributing to that body of knowledge within the CIA. And so that's practically the extent of what I did. The reason why I came out is because of the notion that ALSAP was the Pentagon's UFO program that took up the mantle from back in 1970, January 1970, when Blue Book was officially shut down. That between January 1970 and the beginning of ALSAP, that there was no UFO interest by the US government. And I know that not to be true. Again, 84, 14 years after Blue Book shut down, I discovered that there's still some interest in this phenomenon. So, and it continued throughout and accelerated when orbs were detected in space. Not structured craft, but orbs of light energy, spheres of light energy, plasma balls, if for lack of a better term, were detected, and they were behaving intelligently. And so that was of interest to the intelligence community. And then I got involved at that point, which was later toward my career in 2003, 2004, that I got involved in that. And but not directly. That's when I sent engineers to a study group looking at these orbs. So other than these occurrences and plus my personal experiences, that this extent of my involvement with this topic.
Well, and yeah, and the personal experiences, you've had them. Jim Semivan has had them. I've obviously had them. I don't know if you want to talk particularly in any detail about yours. Jim has talked in some detail about his. I don't know what comfort level you are at, but if you would like to just give us a whatever you feel comfortable saying, I think it'd be an appropriate moment to do that. But before we reach that extremely appropriate moment, folks, we're going to take a little break. We'll be right back. We're talking to John Ramirez. John Ramirez had a long career in the intelligence community, specifically in Central Intelligence Agency. He worked on many different programs. His last appearance on Dreamland in 2021, long time ago now, he talked about observing radars in Russia that had connected in some way with orbs of light that appeared to be intelligently controlled. And this it became a one part of his career path is to study this type of phenomenon. But what about your personal experiences?
Well, certainly I've had these experiences throughout my life. It's not something that was recently as an adult, and I think that's helped me with these experiences and the fact that as a child, and I think most children are more accepting of what they see, touch, feel, and taste. It's a world discovery, so they don't look at it as something scary and strange so much. And so as a child, I had these experiences, which I thought every child had these experiences. I thought it was normal to have these experiences. For example, seeing a structure craft, a large craft that looked like a blimp but was not a blimp. It didn't have any markings on it, didn't have any means of propulsion, didn't have a gondola with pilots in the gondola, no propellers driving the craft, and no aerodynamic surfaces. An example, no fins. It was just a large, I would say a, I don't want to say Tic Tac like, but more blimp like, silver metallic vessel that rose above the forest near where I was staying with my aunt and uncle, and I was out with my cousins and our friends in military housing here in the space, and here I saw it rising above the forest line, and no one else saw it. They didn't know what I was looking at, and I don't think I imagined it. I actually saw it, and I still remember it to this day. But no one else has saw it, and it was something meant for me. And other things that I've encountered were, well, one instance was a book I found that in a five and dime store, and I was thumbing through the book, and there was a little drawing, and I don't remember what the book was about, but I think it was about ancient history or something like that. But it was a little drawing of two primitive humans raising a baby up to the sky, and the mother was raising the baby up to the sky, and above it was a flying saucer craft, a traditional, classic flying saucer, with rays coming down upon the man and a woman holding this baby up. And then what I got was a message, an internal message to me, that this is where you came from and this is who you are. We made you. That was the message I got, and I tried to get this book from my mother, but the book disappeared. And I've had visits to some strange house that I cannot identify, where it was, but it was a Victorian house, and I had encounters with a doctor and a nurse there that that examined me. The doctor undressed me and examined me, and I believe injected me with something. Got me dressed, and I was escorted out by a woman who took me to the house and then escorted me out of the house. And that woman was not my mother, and she could not in any way recount anything that happened to me like that. I never had that type of experience at all with a doctor. So she didn't know what that was about. And I remember being taken as a teenager on board a craft. Strangely, I felt like I needed to plant sunflower seeds outside my bedroom window, which I did. I planted sunflower seeds for the purpose of I want them to find me. And I planted these sunflower seeds, and as they grew into sunflowers, sure enough, they found me. And I went out, remember going out the window. That's the memory I had, that I went out the window and I was carried on board a craft by a being that was, for all intents and purposes, human-like. Because recall two arms and a leg and a torso, and it was holding me in its arms, and it laid me down in some kind of platform, ostensibly for an examination, but I don't recall what happened after that. There have been instances like that off and on throughout my life, too. The most recent was an orb sighting. I seen at least, other than the orb I was shown, the orbs I was shown officially. I've seen one orb out of an aircraft window, and it was an orange orb. And I was listening to United Airlines, the cockpit communications with air control, air traffic control. Back then, they would allow you, before 9/11, allow you to listen to those cockpit communications coming over the entertainment system. And I heard the pilot report to ATC, and I believe he was over the Southwest at the time. And he reported an object going from his left to his right, flying at a very fast rate of speed. And he reported it. And he was asked if he wanted to make a formal report, and he said, no, we were not going to do that. And I looked out my right side window, and there it was, an orange orb flying northward. And we were going west. And if we were over the southwest anyway, it could have been New Mexico, it could have been Arizona. Going north will point to Nevada. So that's something that I've already considered. That's kind of strange. But why did I see that? Well, so happens that on that flight, which I paid for out of my own pocket, and my colleague paid for out of his own pocket, we were flying from Baltimore, Washington International, BWI, to LAX, Los Angeles Airport, and we were going to a UFO conference back then. And so he was fast asleep, and I was in my seat. And for some reason, going to that conference, it was an opportunity for me to see that again, see them again, and the embodiment of an orb. And so there's that connection that's kind of a strange and unusual that I'm going to a UFO conference, and here I see this orb outside of my airplane window as I'm flying to this conference. So there's that. And also an orb over the mountains of Tucson, the Santa Catalina mountain range, that we were doing with a gentleman you might know, Mark Sims. He was doing a radio contact protocol, and my wife and I participated in this protocol. And it was July 14, 2020. It was around about 9:30-ish that we're going through this protocol, and Mark was chanting HU, Hugh, with my wife, and I looked up in the sky, and we kept looking at the sky, and sure enough, for me, a bright orb appeared over the Santa Catalina Mountains, the specific Bighorn Mountain Range. People in Tucson would know what Bighorn Mountain Range means. It was right above that, and my wife saw something to her right. I saw it straight ahead of me, but we're both sitting side by side, so she should have seen it in the same direction I did, but she saw nothing where I saw it. She saw something like a flash of light to her far right. And there it was, another message coming to me that you know about us, and it's time to share what you know, and that you're here to help this one individual with their journey about who we are and what we're about. And I've met that individual later, after that, and I'm still in very close contact, a very good friend that I'm in very close contact with. But there's that message, you know about us, and it's time for you to share. And I took the opportunity to do just that. I took the opportunity to dust off this really old set of slides I had from, I guess 2016 was when I made the slides for a meetup called Cosmic Empowerment in Charlotte. And it was just about the US intelligence community and its role in investigating UFOs. That was the extent of it. And I decided to expand on that set of slides. And that set of slides, my expansion of it, was eventually shown on Project Unity, 74 slide deck. And again, talking about CIA and me being an intelligence asset, well, I knew that it was my responsibility that if I share any information that might be classified, I am obligated to present that information to CIA to get it released for public dissemination. So I took the 74 slides and I contacted CIA and had them review the slides, the Pre-Publication Classification Review Board, PCRB. The Pentagon equivalent is called DOPSR, DOPSR. But PCRB is a CIA process to do this. And I expected a lot of things to be redacted because I threw in everything but the kitchen sink. I wanted to go into what we would call conspiracy theories. I wanted to go and ask if I could talk about certain topics that they may be uncomfortable with me talking about. And one of them was like a Nazi. Perhaps the Nazi influence over UFOs in the terms of what we did, what the exploitation that we did. And I, at that time, had no knowledge whatsoever of magenta, 1933 magenta. I had no knowledge of that. That was news to me when I heard it. But now it makes sense that if the fascist government of Benito Mussolini was able to possess such a craft, it came to their possession, it would make sense that in 1933, somewhere along the line, that the Nazi government under Adolf Hitler would do the same.
Oh,
And
yeah.
perhaps they were able to advance that technology far more than the Italians, and that a lot of things they developed as wonder weapons were based on that technology. And then that technology was transferred after Italy fell in 1944, eventually transferred to the United States, perhaps to Wright Patterson. Back then it was called U.S. Army Air Force Wright Pat Field, because
Yeah.
there was no Air Force back then. It was the U.S. Army Air Force, and it was called just Wright Field. No, Wright Patterson, just Wright Field.
Yeah, one of my uncles worked there and
Yes.
in Air Materiel and was one of the officers who received the debris from Roswell. He never mentioned the existence of the object from Italy, and probably if he had no need to know, he wouldn't have been told about it.
Right.
But he did say one very interesting thing. He said when he looked into it, it was empty. It was just struts, and there was no seats, and there was no propulsion. He didn't say seats. He said there was no motor. That was his exact word. And I'm wondering, I've always, since I learned about the Mantegna object, I thought to myself, maybe he was telling me that he looked into that UFO, because I'm not sure that the Roswell one was brought to Wright intact. So I was it's sort of it, it's quite fascinating. I mean, I wish he was still with us because I could question him more, but he was such a tight-lipped. I mean, you've known, I'm sure, plenty of intelligence officers who were rather tight-lipped and are tight-lipped. He spent his entire career seconded to the Atomic Energy Commission, which means that he worked on this subject in all probability, because the Majestic, what's called publicly the Majestic program, went to the AEC in the late 40s or early 50s, and he went with it. I'm glad he talked to me at all, and he just talked to me once. And he left me with this, but I just am wondering always what we know about the way these things run, because there's some kind of a symbiosis. I found out in working on my book, The Fourth Mind, between the bodies of the pilots and the objects' propulsion systems. And, I've heard the same rumors, I'm sure you have, that we do have an ability to operate these, some of them, but I don't know that that could be the case. What do you think? Where are we? And I'm understanding that you touched on this in before night 2009, and also that this is not an area that you probably would have been exposed to being in CIA and not in one of the technology related intelligence operations. What do you think we it, are we getting anywhere in terms of propulsion systems?
I would say so, only because of the publication I encountered that I wasn't supposed to see. As you recall, I mentioned that I sent two engineers to the Orb Study Group, and they came
Yes.
back with a lot of information that they couldn't tell me about, and I refused to be read into what they knew. For some reason, I was compelled in my own mind. It was a strong feeling that I should not be read into what they know. And even though it was offered to me that, do you want to be read into this, what we're doing? And I go, no, I really don't. And that's because I felt like I already knew what they were dealing with. But two engineers were sent, and they asked for a safe, and they had a lot of materials compartmented materials of program I was not read into, a compartment or program I was not privy to. And one of my engineers had a publication out on his desk face front. So the cover sheet was exposed face front, and I was walking around my branch. I was branch chief then, and I saw that cover sheet, the cover of this publication. It wasn't a dirt, it wasn't like a dozen pages of white paper material unsolicited. This was a publication that someone or a team of people might have worked on, and it was fairly thick. And it was about UFO propulsion systems and how they worked. And that was on the cover. The title of the publication was UFO Propulsion Systems, and a subtitle was something about how they work. That led me to believe that there is such a program to exploit the propulsion system, and somebody somewhere found a lot of information about UFO propulsion systems that was held in this program, in the compartment of this program, which I did not have. And as soon as I saw that and was re saw the cover, my engineer apologized, flipped the book over so I couldn't see it. Sorry, boss. And he knew that was a security violation to leave it out. It would have been a security violation for me to open that. If I had opened that book publication in any way, shape, or form, I would have been assessed. He would have reported me for security violation. I would have been in big trouble. But he placed the publication back into that safe and locked it up. So a UFO propulsion book, a publication from the government in a compartment I did not have, would lead me to believe that there was such a program to exploit the propulsion system. Otherwise, why would that publication have been written? So that's the only evidence I had, my personal evidence, that I saw this publication about UFO propulsion systems. And there is such a study about UFO propulsion systems to the extent that a publication had to be written. So there's that. So
Because, of
I
course, Ross Coulthart said that he had it on impeccable authority
yeah.
that the Tic Tac was built by Lockheed Martin.
Oh, I don't know if the Tic Tac was built by Lockheed Martin. He has his sources, and so I can only go by what other people say, because I don't have any knowledge
Yeah.
of who built Tic Tac or what Tic Tac was. I have no direct personal knowledge of it. Even though the occurrence happened in 2004 while I was still in CIA, I had no knowledge of it. However, strangely enough, this working group was established in 2004. So there's that coincidence. And it continued in 2005. And I believe in 2006, it was completely shut down. They were finished. And after that, what happened was OSAP took over. So the intelligence community, what I call the Title 50 side of the intelligence community, which is primarily CIA and the civilian side of the Pentagon intelligence agencies, studied orbs. And then later, that study may have been tossed over to the Title 10 side, the Department of Defense side, which would have then involved the uniformed services and their intelligence components of the uniformed services to go forward with that study under a contract that we now know was with Bigelow Aerospace. So there's that lineage of information being passed from one study to another. So could we have developed something like Tic Tac? Maybe. Was Tic Tac a Lockheed Martin vehicle? Why would a Lockheed Martin vehicle be exposed if it's so secret to naval aviators? And why would that be a test of their reaction to seeing that vehicle? It doesn't make sense to me that it was a test. The reason why is because when these exercises are conducted, they're meticulously planned. Everyone in the exercise is thoroughly briefed as to the scope and mission of the exercise, the parameters of the exercise, the area of the exercise to be held in, their entire like publications released for the exercise that people will follow. It's a script. And this was an unscripted event. It surprised the aviators. And you don't do that when you have an operational flight of FA-18s getting prepared for deployment. They were out there doing some exercise. You don't interrupt that exercise with another exercise that they don't know about, because you don't know what the reaction of those aviators might have been. And it could have caused an aviation disaster. I mean,
Oh,
you just
yeah,
don't show
easily.
up and play around with fighter jets like that. You have no way of determining how that script is going to go forward, because there is no script, and you wouldn't do that. So I discount anything about this being a known test of a U.S. vehicle to test the reaction of naval aviators. It doesn't make sense, because the test is telemetered. There's all kinds of instrumentation on board ships, on board other aircraft, not the fighters, and also on the fighters, that there are collection systems on board above and beyond what's already in part of that fighter. So the FLIR, the forward-looking infrared device, is already part of that fighter, and that's not an instrumented scientific device at all. That is practical. Just pr pr that is there to for target acquisition for their missiles. The missiles are infrared. They have infrared seekers, and there's an infrared detector to then control those missiles. Well, you fire the missiles, and then the infrared detector, the FLIR, will guide the missile toward its target. And so that's what was there, was a FLIR device that was part of the fighter. Although if it was a real test, the pilots would have been thoroughly briefed. There would have been other packages on other aircraft and on the fighters themselves that are collection packages, not sensors, but collection packages. There's a big difference between a sensor and a collection package, and it would have been a collection system to conduct that test. So I would say, in between, I would say, could have Lockheed Martin developed a craft that we now know was Tic Tac, something like that? Yes, they could have developed something like that. Who knows? I don't know. I have absolutely no knowledge
Yeah.
of that. But could have been NHI? I don't know. I have no knowledge that it was NHI. But I would discount that it was a test of the pilots flying those FA-18s. Everyone with the Nimitz and with the escorting ships would have known about that test. It would have been a planned, scripted test. Specifically, those planes would have took off for that test, and not just
Yes.
flying around to a cap point. And
And
then
you
here
can hear
comes
the
this new
voices.
technology.
These people are generally not very good at. I don't know too many military people who are really expert liars. They're not like CIA people who are, for some of them, very good at it. But not you, not you. You're a very straight-ahead guy, in my experience. In like Jim Semivan is willing to come out and talk about his experiences and his wife's very frankly. And I hope David Grush will too one of these days. He should, because his experiences are worth knowing. In any case, the Tic Tac moved at one point from 50,000 feet to sea level and into the sea at 70,000 miles an hour. And I don't think it was built by Lockheed Martin. Not only that, the Twining Memorandum from 1947, written by General Twining, describes flight characteristics very similar to those that are seen today in things like the Tic Tac. So, but I always hope that we have cracked it, you know, because I know that if we have agency in this, whoever's out there is going to be more open with us. And I do think that they are in control of this disclosure process. I see people like Anna Paulina Luna and Adam Schiff striving so hard to get the government's vast, slow-moving system to open something up for us. And I think to myself, I know who's behind this and who's controlling it, And it's not us. It's whoever ran that Tic Tac. And I don't think it was Lockheed Martin. They are in control, in my experience, of everything that has to do with them. And I want to now, we're going to take a break in a moment, but after we come back, I would like to circle back to the idea of the distant past that we touched on earlier in the context of the possibility that movement through time has something to do with this. We will be right back, folks. We're talking to John Ramirez, a long and distinguished career in the Central Intelligence Agency, during which, from time to time, he touched on the UAP issue. And this is, of course, what we have been discussing. Before we left the air for the free, those on the free side, and do subscribe to unknowncountry.com, follow John's example. He's a lifetime subscriber, and I would love another lifetime subscriber. We get them once in a coon's age, that is to say, maybe once or twice a year. And they're very, very appreciated. So, time, movement through time in this, I've touched this a few times, and I've always thought that if you were going to go back into your own past, how would you defeat the grandfather paradox, which is you can't go back into the past to change anything that would affect your own grandfather and therefore your present? How do you get around that? And one way would be if you disguised yourself as something that didn't exist at all. You made reference to human being put on a table by someone who looked very human. Do you suppose you were in a time machine?
I don't know. I do not know. Certainly it's possible. Certainly it could be impossible. I have no opinion on that. I don't recall there being any back then any inkling on my part that I was in a any kind of time vessel of any sort.
Have you ever thought about the possibility that this may have something to do with time?
Yes, I have. And in a way that answers some of the questions, but also brings up other questions, of course. And I don't think there's one single explanation for the phenomenon. Time certainly seems to have some aspect to the phenomenon. People have missed time. We all know of stories of people with missing time.
Yeah,
And,
you're looking at one of them. I have it. I've had it right in this apartment.
oh, yes. And
You
I
know,
know
when I
of.
had it was very interesting. I hadn't seen Danny Sheehan in years. And our mutual friend, Mark Sims, was coming over and bringing Danny with him. They're close friends. And I had a 7-minute missing time experience about half an hour before they arrived.
Yeah. Yeah,
Fascinating.
I know talking about witnesses who could come forward but haven't and won't come forward. I have a friend at CIA. He allowed me to use his first name, and I can only use his first name because he was undercover back then. His name was Mick, and he had a missing time experience as a child. When he was very small, he went to his backyard, and his property bordered on some woods, and he saw this light in the woods, and he walked toward that light. And then the next thing he knew that he was walking back home. But his parents were quite distraught and angry at him for like running off. And for him, it was just a few minutes. It couldn't have been more than that. But for his parents, in real time, he was gone for hours. And so there's that. And so happens that he was one of the individuals at CIA that had the experiences, and as well as experiences with the lady in white. He told me about this long before anyone knew about Chris Bledsoe and his experience. He had this in early 2000s. early 2000s that he encountered this lady in white, and he told me about it, and he had a message for him, a personal message for him. So there's that as well. So time might have something to do with the phenomenon.
You
And
know,
I can't talk too much more about that because I've heard that that could possibly be a thing, that time is a factor to be considered when encountering a phenomenon. And maybe not all experiences with NHI, but certain of them, for all intents and purposes, they behave, like you say, as like a time traveler would, not wanting to upset the timeline, but to observe the timeline and whatever means they have to observe that without interfering with the timeline. And I will also say that as far as the paradox, everything we know now as his past history, we don't know if they had occurred. It could have been, if time travelers from the future did upset the timeline, then what we know this exact second as having occurred may have been changed and adjusted for us at this exact moment. And I think when there's a kink in that there's some something to upset that flow, that it causes the Mandela effect. So you have people who believe that Mandela died in prison, and other people said no, he eventually was released in prison and became a leader for his country of South Africa. You have that, and could that be the result of a kink in that non-interference of
In the
time?
timeline. Yeah, I
Yeah,
used to
but
have a patient.
what we know now to be history could have already been adjusted in the past so that we would not know. So I have grandparents that died a certain time, and perhaps my memory of their death is a result of something that happened in the past, that in a certain timeline they did not die when they did, and another timeline they did, that kind of thing. But my
Yeah.
point being that time is dynamically adjusted all the time. It just happens to be that what we think of history could have been adjusted time already. And so there's no paradox.
Well, Anne and I knew a lady. I have her back on Dreamland. She's still around, called Starfire Tor, who, I mean, that was obviously not her real name, but that was what she calls herself. And she's a lovely person and very brilliant, who could actually cause time slips. This was her forte, in fact. And I have no idea how she did it. She did it just by noticing them, and she caused us to experience two fantastic time slips, one in witnessed with other people. So they're real, they do happen. And that means that the flow of reality is very much more complex than we think. And this gets me back to a comment you made earlier about the fact that we can communicate with animals on our planet who also have a level of intelligence. But can we really? We can't know the way they feel and ex about the world and the way they experience it. We can only know how they react to us. And isn't that the same situation with NHI in both directions? We can't know how they experience the world, only how they react to us, and vice versa. So where does that leave us in terms of communication? And especially if something like this is the case, they do have, hypothetically, a vastly a very, very advanced control of movement through time. They find us in the vast miracle of the universe, a little speck here that these little creatures running around on it. They come here, and in order to relate to us, the first thing they do is they interject themselves all across our timeline into the distant past. Then they appear. And it looks to us like they've been here forever, when there maybe have been here only a little short time.
Now that's intriguing.
Yeah,
I've
isn't it?
not considered that possibility before, but based on my personal belief about adjusting history, that could have certainly be a case. Like you said, it's very
Yeah.
difficult to prove or to even study this from that perspective. But it would make sense that they can instantly go back at any period of time, show up, and then that appearance becomes part of human knowledge, human history, and people write about it, write about the encounter in ancient texts. And so there's that ancient text, but
Exactly.
that appearance could have happened just very recently, as you said. But now it becomes part of our human history that, these ancient humans encountered these various beings and described them. That could have been. That makes sense. But I mean, like you said, it's all speculation. And how do we know? I would
But of
say
course, the
that we won't know until we die. I think when we die, I think we'll then finally say, "Oh, that's what it was all about." But right now, I have no idea what it's about. I just know what's occurring here and now in the present.
We have to end the free side of the show, sadly enough. Free Dream, those of you on the free side, I want to say thank you for being part of Dreamland, and join us in the subscriber area sometime. It's a lot of fun. You get to a nice social level to it, and you get to hear a lot more and explore the site more deeply. We're talking to John Ramirez, and John has been very open with us and very kind in discussing these subjects. And I would like to turn now to things like I listened to you on Psychoactivo. That's a wonderful, he's a great guy. Pavel Ibarra, I believe his name is. Yeah, and you mentioned something a couple of things I'd like to explore. One of them is heritages and the fact that this does seem to concentrate among people of a certain heritages. You mentioned specifically Cherokee and Celtic. I'm
Yes.
wondering where you heard that.
It was from a former CIA officer who was in a position to have that direct information. And that's
Because
all I
that
can
would
say.
mean that they have d studied this demographically very deeply.
Or has had access to information about certain backgrounds. For example, there are special operators in the special operations community, special operators, as well as intelligence community officers who've had these experiences, particularly also with implants, who've had implants removed. And so there is a database of these officers, and the part of that database is their ethnicity, their heritage. And there's a preponderance of Celtic and Cherokee Indian heritage, particularly Cherokee Indian heritage, with a one-to-one correlation almost of having these experiences. So not all folks with Cherokee heritage have experiences, but people with experiences have a high degree of probability of having Cherokee Indian heritage. And also, that's true with Celtic as well. So that could have something to do with bloodlines, and I don't know what the bloodline connection would be, other than CIA seems to be aware of the bloodline connection, as related to me by the chief historian in 2001, His name was Gerald K. Haynes, and you might know that name as the
Yes, I
author
do.
of the publication, CIA's Involvement with UFOs from 1947 to 1990. Gerald K. Haynes did state that CIA was interested in these bloodlines, these of tracking alien DNA. And so there's that as well. I have no idea why Cherokee or why Celtic whatsoever. I don't know why those two heritages, but it's just in the database that there's a high preponderance of experiencers, particularly those with implants, with that in their family backgrounds.
Yeah, I have an implant and I have Celtic heritage, and so did my wife. And here's a little aside that's always been very weird, that we always felt were kind of was kind of fun and completely inexplicable to us. People would overhear us when we were alone sometimes and didn't realize anyone could hear us talking together. They would say, "What language were you speaking?" And we'd say, "English." They'd say, "No." And it was something else. And one of them was a language teacher. And he said, "You were speaking Gaelic."
Oh.
Isn't that fascinating? We had no idea of that. But then, you know, we both love the Gaelic language. We love listening to it. I've got dozens of CDs and stuff on my Spotify and my Apple Music of people singing in the Gaelic language, and I don't understand a word of it consciously, but I love it. And I have a very deep heritage there too. So to me, that makes sense. And when we had the communion letters and we had all of these lists of people who had written us, there were a lot of people with Irish names and so forth, and quite a few people from the Native American community. I can't say for sure they were Cherokee, but they were from the Native American community, yes. I wonder why that is. It's very strange.
I
Are
can
we
speculate.
colonized? Is this a co are we col are we colonials? Do you have any Celtic or Cherokee
Cher
name?
Cherokee, no, not Celtic. My wife does have Celtic heritage.
So you're a double whammy.
My wife is a lifelong experiencer herself from childhood, has had past lives that she recalls. And so she is Scotland and Ireland. Is her heritage with some German and Welsh. Again, I don't know what to say about this at all, other than my father told me a story when I was very small. My father told me that his grandmother, which would have been my great grandmother, was full-blooded Cherokee, and that she was considered to be a strange person. Amongst her people, because she would always do prophecies and do healings and whatnot for intents and purposes. I guess you would call that a shaman of sorts. But she would have that as part of her life, to do these things. And my father told me, my grandmother told me that. The Cherokee people, oh, that my grandmother told me that the Atlantis was a real place, that it actually existed, and the Cherokee people came from Atlantis.
They
And
came
there's
up.
that. I don't know
The Hopi did too.
if Atlantis was a real place. Let's assume, let's speculate, assume that Atlantis was a real place, and something disastrous happened to Atlantis, and there were survivors. If it was in the Atlantic Ocean, where whence it gets its name, if you go west, you'll hit the Americas, and if you go east, you'll hit Europe and you'll hit the British Isles and you'll hit
That's right.
Ireland and Great Britain.
Well,
So
I never
there's
thought of it
that
that way before.
aspect as well.
I'd never thought of it that way before. Because, you know, in at the climactic period of the Ice Age, when it was ending, At one point, the oceans of this planet rose 450 feet in a matter of days, and that is in the geologic record. That's when what we think of now as Atlantis disappeared. Because all of the coastal communities disappeared. If you look at a map of the world at night, you will see lines of light concentrated on all of the coasts. If you had looked at a map of the world during the Ice Age, you might have found maybe not as extensive lighting, but certainly civilization clinging to coastlines. That now is between 300 and 500 feet underwater, and there has been zero underwater archaeology at that depth because it is too far down to go in search of something that everyone assumes could not be there. There was, however, a deeply inundated city off the coast of Cuba that was supposedly going to be discovered, explored by the National Geographic Society, and that all went away mysteriously. Not only do we not know about our past and who we really are, somebody, it seems to me, doesn't want us to know. And I find, do you find that to be the case, that there's a sort of an effort to keep us in ignorance about who we really are?
I don't know if anything official with that intent whatsoever. There is a term known as a forbidden archaeology. You've probably heard that term. But I don't know if that is a concerted program by any entity on the planet to keep that hidden whatsoever. It just seems that there's a high degree of burden of proof for a lot of these discoveries. And I know that other than off the coast of Cuba, off the Japanese islands, there's also been structures found. And this structure is rather large and like blocks of stone, like flat blocks of stone. And sure enough, there are like scientists who say, well, that's just a natural occurring thing. And I just don't understand that at all. That this could be a natural occurring thing.
Well, Graham Hancock has been a dear friend for many, many years, and he's the one who dived for that thing. And he can tell you unequivocally it's not natural and can give you chapter and verse as to why. But it is structurally very different from something we would create, and why it was built is a mystery too. But there's lots of mysteries like that in the world. There's Nan Madol in the Pacific, built of 750,000 basalt logs that were all quarried nearby. But how were they moved, and who moved them, and why? It's absolutely, it's a group of artificial islands. The National Geographic Society originally, after having carbon dated a fire pit that they found, dated them to the 12th century AD and announced that Polynesians in canoes must have moved them. And then I think some nautical engineers explained to them that that was not possible. And that story sort of disappeared from their website, and now they just kind of talk about it without explaining it. Do you have any sense of, and this is both a personal question from a man whom I know has really great depths not only in the contact experience, but in his bloodline, and also a certain amount of exposure to this in the intelligence community. Do you have any sense of there ever having been a higher human technology here that we've lost?
No, I don't. I don't have any information about that. Certainly, again, going back to religious texts, looking at the Bible, there certainly seem to have been directed energy described. If you look at some of the miracles that have occurred, calling down fire from the sky to burn up the sacrifice. I think there was a contest between one of the prophets and the priests of another civilization, and there was a contest to see who can bring down fire from the sky to light up the sacrifice and or whatever it was, and so the prophet was able to do that. And there's also the recorded the miracles of Moses, of turning the staff into a serpent and other kind of things that kind of defy known even today's physics. There's the burning bush, the voice from the burning bush, and things like that. I describe the cloud above them to deliver manna from heaven. But again, even changing water into wine. There have been records of old occurrences like that that seem to defy unknown physics. That could have been technology that we lost.
Yeah, technology that we lost.
The wheels within wheels, seen by what is it, the prophet Ezekiel saw wheels within wheels, and it was suspended in the air. So that could have been, but I don't know if these are like there could have been manifestations of NHI technology to humans, or I don't think it's human technology that's been lost. I think it's other technology that humans have encountered, and.
Yeah, you're probably right about that.
Yeah, and try to
Right.
interpret.
Now, one of the things we discussed the last time we were together, I wanted to bring up, which is the your you were involved in the Electronic Intelligence Division of CIA, and that relates to your interest in UAPs and in what happened when you were studying the Russian radars. Could you revisit that a little bit? Because I'm sure some of my listeners would like to know what that was all about.
Exactly. And of course, we didn't call them UAPs back then. And it was a branch. It was the Electronic Intelligence Analysis Branch. Back then, when I joined, it was called the Emissions Analysis Branch within CIA, Director of Science and Technology within the Office of Signals Intelligence Operations. And so we looked at all kinds of emissions from what we call DC to daylight, including acoustic and magnetic, electromagnetic. And a little bit of electro-optical as well. We looked at all of that, and so I was assigned a radar in a place called Sarishagan in what is now Kazakhstan, and this was an area that was used as a missile test center. It's called Sarishagan Missile Test Center, and they would launch missiles under test to Sarishagan, and these radars would track the missiles. These were ballistic missiles with inert nuclear warheads. They're not. They were contained ballast to represent the throw weight of a nuclear warhead. And they would detect these, and as well as detecting the missile coming down toward impact, they would also detect other objects surrounding the missile. And so that was what piqued the interest of the U.S. intelligence community, particularly back then, the Foreign Technology Division at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. They study this extensively, and other intelligence assets have also seen these objects to the point that an aircraft known as Cobra Ball not only saw the missile and tracked the missile, but there was a wall of white cloud, a curtain of white that was approaching them at 6,200 miles per hour, very, very fast. That they were able to detect and I believe record. I believe there's a recording because this aircraft, Cobra Ball, has something called the real-time optical system, RTOS, RTOS, which would have recorded anything like that. And there's a very sophisticated collection system, more so than like a FLIR. It can actually record scientific data of what is being presented to it. So there are other instances throughout my early career where I saw that the Russians, at least, were detecting what we would today call UAPs, what the US called domes of light phenomena. So that was my involvement with the early part of my career with what we would call UAPs. I did not join UCIA to study UAPs. I was never assigned UAPs. There was no such UFO office, UFO Legacy Program Office. There's no such thing as that. It's just that there was a body of knowledge held within the intelligence community of these detections by sophisticated collection systems and by ground observations that was in the database. And so that was my involvement to study the radar, but also to study what the radar was tracking. And what the radar is tracking was more than just missiles. It was also tracking other objects. Particularly the SS-20 was one that attracted a lot of these orbs. There were orbs flying along with the SS-20, which was an intermediate range ballistic missile that was removed by treaty. We got rid of our Pershing 2 and ground launch cruise missiles, the Pershing 2 missiles based in Germany, which a recent witness, John Blitch, was a commander of one of the batteries, and also ground launch cruise missiles. We got rid of those. The Russians got rid of the SS-20s, but the orbs still followed Russian missiles. And we built a collection system on the ground that was able to detect these types of objects, as well as the missile itself, the missile complex, as we call it. And the Cobra Ball aircraft, with great detail, you can actually see the warheads coming down from space down to the ground. You can actually look at them, and they actually conical type objects that spin stabilized reentry vehicles coming down. And along with that, you have detections of this other phenomenon. What is that phenomenon? Well, is it Russian countermeasures? Certainly, that was the original theory behind what we were seeing. These are Russian countermeasures that are accompanying the missile complex. So, along with the actual active reentry vehicle with the active nuclear warhead, they're also going to drop these orbs to confuse our detection of their attack. That was the prevailing theory back then. And it probably still is. I haven't heard anything to discount that.
Right, I'm sure it is. Anything energetic, especially hot or electronically active, is going to be potentially a disruptive factor in attempting to intercept
Right.
something like that.
But what the difference, Whitley, is that we've seen the same phenomenon behaving intelligently in formation. So, and in the absence of a missile launch. So, I guess if they're only seen during missile launches, you can make the case that it is ballistic missile countermeasures directed at us. But when you see these objects flying over Russian space, and we are detecting them, and the Russians are detecting them, and we're both wondering if and attributing this phenomenon to the other side. Americans thinking it's the Russians thinks it's Americans, then you know something is up, that it is not ballistic missile countermeasure. So there's that to consider. And that was what started the orb study that occurred in the early 2000s, that we were able to detect these objects in space because we now had the capability of putting infrared detectors, sophisticated infrared collection systems in space. The DSP is not a collection system. The DSP, the Defense Support Program, is a sensor. It's a sensor. It detects radiance against a cooler background. So a sensor is not a collection system. A sensor is a dumb collection system. A sensor is like the radar warning receiver in your car. It beeps and saying, "Hey, there is a police radar ahead of you. Slow down." It doesn't give you any scientific information other than beeping because it can detect and then report to you that there's a detection. But a collection system actually records data to the point that you can actually then look into the data and extract from it intelligence. You can extract the structure of the signal and what that signal is associated with. So we can detect, like, okay, this part of the telemetry signal has to do with fuel consumption. This part of the telemetry signal has to do with maneuvers. This part of the telemetry signal has to do with the disposition of the rocket engine, like main engine cut off, secondary engine light off. All of that is connected to telemetry systems. We can also detect when the dummy warhead activates. We can actually see the triggers of the nuclear warheads under test. They don't have nuclear materials, so they don't explode, but all the other accoutrements associated with a warhead is telemetered. So we can detect and then break it out and actually know how far this missile can fly, how high it can fly, and how much megatonnage the missile can carry. It's all part of ICBM intelligence. So it was that type of collection that we were able to determine these are orbs flying over Russian space in a very controlled manner in formation. What are they? And so that's what launched that study, and from which I sent my two engineers, with one of them leaving a publication out in the open. So that's closing the loop on that.
That's the story.
And that was before OSSAT. OSSAT was not in anyone's mind whatsoever before that study. After that study, OSSAT was launched.
Here's a question for you that's certainly been much on many minds, including my own. You may have an insight into it, a personal insight based on your experience. What do you think the controllers of these orbs, whoever they may be, would do if we actually had a nuclear conflict, if a nuclear missiles were launched in anger? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, I can only go back toward history because there's only been one instance, two instances of nuclear weapons used in warfare. And that was in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the NHI did nothing to prevent Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now we have even greater capabilities. These are like, I don't know, 12 kilotons, 15 kilotons. There was very small weapons, considering today's standard of like having hundreds of kilotons, if not megatons. Of nuclear yield. In the United States, our reentry vehicles are so precise that we don't need high megatonnage. We need high kilotonnage. So our reentry vehicles can operate can yield hundreds of thousands of kilotons, like 150,000 kilotons, for example. And we also have weapons in Europe that are 100 free fall bombs that you can dial a yield as low as 0.3 kilotons to as high as, thousands of kilotons. So there's a 50,000 kilotons, I think, is the largest yield for a free fall the B50 B63 -12 bomb. I think that's the designator, B63-12. We have those in storage. Now, as far as a war going on where we use them, how can I tell? We're trying to prevent any such war from occurring. However, you look at the storage places where these weapons are stored, and if you look at places where these weapons are designed, like the national laboratories, Los Alamos National Laboratory, for example, if you look at those facilities and you look at places where nuclear weapons are stored, in the inventory and where there are positioned for use and launch silos, there's a presence of these objects. So obviously they're somewhat interested in our nuclear weapons program in terms of to extent of our advancements in them. But as far as preventing them, they've already demonstrated that they're able to prevent a launch from occurring on the US side. They shut down several Minuteman missiles, and they did not disable the nuclear warheads. That is a misconception in the public. People say, well, they shut down the nuclear warheads. No, they shut down the delivery systems for the nuclear warheads, which were still intact on the Minuteman at Maelstrom on May 16th, 1967. Those warheads were still live. There was absolutely no way of delivering them if the missile shut down. If you can't launch the missile because there was a fault, 10 fault lights turned on. And because of the fault, they were not able to put these missiles in launch readiness. Ready to go could not have occurred. No go for launch. So there's that interaction with our nuclear weapons. On the Russian side, I understand there have been interactions as well. Just an anecdote, I have no intelligence or no professional knowledge of this, but an anecdote I heard was that instead of preventing to launch, they were on a launch, that they were on a launch countdown, that they were getting ready to launch and they couldn't shut
Right, I
down
heard
that
that
launch.
too.
Right. So, it makes sense to me because the Russians had a first strike capability that they would launch first, right? We had a counter
Right.
strike, that is, we will wait for their launch before we launch. And so, in a way, they demonstrated that we can upset your nuclear weapons policy. That if the Russians, you want to launch first, we will prevent you. We will give you the capability to launch first. How does that feel to lose control of your launch capabilities? And on the US side, if you want to react to a Russian launch, how does it feel to lose the ability to launch to counteract or counterstrike a Russian launch? So that was demonstrated for us on May 16, 67. On May 17, 67, there were 1,000 Minuteman missiles in the United States and 54 Titan II missiles in the United States. Well, on May seven, on March 17, 67, missile number 1,000 arrived at Malmstrom with much fanfare. And you can look it up in the ICB official Air Force history of ICBMs at Malmstrom's. It's listed there that missile number 1,000 arrived and then was placed in its silo in May of 67. So between March and May of 67, that silo was prepared, received the missile number 1,000. And then what happened in late June, I believe, in 67, President Lyndon Baines Johnson spoke with his counterpart, Premier Alexei Kosygin. And Johnson proposed that we reduce the number of nuclear weapons. And Kosygin agreed that that's a good thing to do. And eventually, in the next administration, under Nixon and under Brezhnev, they signed the first SALT treaty to limit strategic weapons. So that all came back to Malmstrom, demonstrating to us, hey, we can mess with your nuclear launch capabilities. Maybe you have too many missiles,
Yeah.
maybe that was message received by the U.S. government that we should look into reducing the number of nuclear weapons. I don't know. In that sense, they may have prevented this at that time before the SALT Treaty. There was like an unbridled program to build more nuclear missiles, to build more than what we had, to expand our nuclear missile capabilities, to put more warheads on one missile. The Russians had the same, but now we're both working toward reducing the amount of missiles. So in that sense, they may have prevented a further escalation of nuclear warhead development.
John Ramirez, I want to thank you for being with us on Dreamland. I could talk to you all day, but I'm sure you have a life waiting for you out there, just like I do, and my listeners do. It has been such a remarkable and insightful journey with you today. I just hope that everyone gained as much benefit from it as I have. And thank you for all that you do, and above all, for your willingness to come out and say your piece so honestly and in such a forthright manner. So, thank you.
Thank you, Whitley, for having me again.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.